You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi. After coasting to an easy win to become the Republican nominee for governor Tuesday night, Oregon State Senator Christine Drazen will face incumbent Tina Kotek, a Democrat, in November. Drazen held a commanding lead in the polls over opponents State Representative Ed Deal and Chris Dudley, a former Oregon trailblazer. Drazen acknowledges that Trump is unpopular in Oregon, but she believes Oregonians recognize that many of the state's problems, like homelessness, poor achievement scores in schools, and a broken mental health system, predate the president's re-election in 2024. The last time a Republican won an Oregon's governor race was in 1982. Drazen has a steep hill to climb, but voter registration figures show that Democrats' longtime advantage has narrowed since Kotek defeated Drazen in the November 2022 election. Another considerable factor in this year's race is the absence of a significant third-party candidate. This story comes to us through a news partnership with Oregon Journalism Project and was reported by Nigel Jacquees. Warrenton hopes to fix its reputation with developers with the introduction of a new planning director. The city announced it hired Anne-Marie Skinner to fill the role. Previously, she served as chief planner in Concord, New Hampshire's Community Development Department and was director of planning and community development for Lincoln City. Warrenton has suffered from high turnover in the planning director position, as well as other staff changes involving building officials and code enforcement officers. At a recent meeting, Mayor Pro Tem Paul Mitchell presented his findings on how to fix the city's relationship with builders. The city has spent much of the past year fixing its development code, getting it to comply with new state regulations and taking out arbitrary language that can be misinterpreted. Mitchell also said the shortage of planning professionals is an issue for small communities like Warrenton, where living expenses are high but salaries are lower. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Columbia Press. Tillamook School District has a new superintendent. Jennifer Guarcello has served as the district's interim superintendent this past school year. She will permanently step into the role with a 3-year contract approved by the Board of Directors. Guarcello is a third-generation Tillamook County resident and has a long history with the district's schools. She graduated from Tillamook High School before attending Pacific University. She moved back to the area to teach first grade at South Prairie Elementary School and later served as principal of Liberty Elementary for 9 years. She has also worked at the Tillamook School District. This summer, the Tillamook School District will begin work on a slew of projects funded by a $23 million bond approved by voters last year. Liberty Elementary is slated for a seismic resiliency upgrade in addition to renovations. Tillamook Junior High and East Elementary will receive new gyms. The high school's roof will be replaced and a new field house will be added to the campus, among other improvements. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald, online at tillamookheadlightherald.com. The Long Beach Peninsula's Ocean Beach School District lost out on funding to keep construction on track at its middle and high school campus in Ilwaco. But a recent victory has allowed the district to continue investigations into upgrades for earthquake and tsunami preparedness at its 2 elementary schools. Utilizing $300,000 in funding awarded by the state, the school district began more extensive work earlier this year to determine the viability of proposed solutions to keep students and staff at Long Beach Elementary and Ocean Park Elementary safe in the event of a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake and tsunami. One proposal has been to relocate Long Beach Elementary to higher ground in Ilwaco. For Ocean Park Elementary, Ocean Beach Superintendent Amy Huntley says building a vertical evacuation tower on site or across the street could be the more financially prudent option. As this first phase of work continues, Huntley said the district hopes to ramp up public engagement in the summer with surveys as well as community forums on both ends of the peninsula. Huntley said the community will not bear the cost if state funding falls through. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. Dozens of states have sought to move away from cash bail in recent years to reduce the burdens on poor defendants. Now, public defenders are asking the Washington Supreme Court to restrict the use of bail here. Their proposal has ignited a debate about fairness and whether the court even has the authority to make these changes. KUOW's Amy Radel explains.
Katie Hurley is an attorney with King County's Department of Public Defense. She and her colleagues see people burdened by unaffordable bail that can mean longer jail stays for people who haven't been convicted of a crime.
The pretrial incarceration system becomes a system of punishment, and that is not what the system is intended to be. The system is supposed to be designed to ensure people's release and to make sure they can come back to court.
So Hurley developed a proposal that asks the Washington Supreme Court to restrict the use of bail in three ways. Public defenders want more people to pay 10% of their bail straight to the court where it's refundable, instead of to bail bond agents who keep that 10% fee. Public defenders want to exempt more people from bail entirely, and they want to cap bail for many misdemeanors so people can pay just $20 to the court to get out of jail. Courtney Weimer is a bail bond agent in Tacoma and president of the State Agents Association. She says when she pays someone's bail, she and the defendant's family all work together to get the person to court. She doesn't think people will show up if they have just $20 on the line.
You can go and steal up to $750 and have it be a gross misdemeanor, and I don't think they're going to care about $20. But again, if you've got your mom or grandma going, hey, you better get your butt to court, they're going to care about that.
On weekday afternoons, Weimer crosses the street from her bail bond company to Pierce County Superior Court. She says there's often little rhyme or reason to some of the judge's bail decisions. On this day, a judge releases a man with 40 arrests and a record of failing to appear in court while imposing bail on a woman with a job and a fixed address. Washington State's constitution ensures that most people are released on bail while awaiting trial. For those in custody, Weimer says,
it's because that person either has a lengthy criminal history, a lengthy history of not appearing, or it's a dangerous crime. That's why they're sitting in jail. It's not because they're poor.
Weimer opposes changing the rules, which would largely take businesses like hers out of the equation. She thinks reducing the use of cash bail means fewer people will show up to their court dates. That's a concern for the King County Prosecutor's Office as well. Here's staff attorney Patrick Hines.
If a defendant, in fact, fails to appear, particularly repeatedly fails to appear, that can entirely disrupt any ability to bring that defendant's case to a resolution.
Tiffany Attrell is co-founder of the Victim Justice Coalition. She wants the proposal debated by lawmakers, not the state Supreme Court.
Nowhere in these proposed changes is there any comment on crime victims or the impact that this would have on them. And we feel like this type of sweeping changes need to be put forth before the legislature.
That's how other states have implemented bail reform. But Washington Supreme Court Justice Sal Mangia chairs the Rules Committee and says he thinks these changes are within the court's purview.
There is separation of powers here, and bail is part of the judicial process, which in my view, that is the province of our state Supreme Court.
Mangia says he received and read hundreds of comments from the public about these proposed changes. Most comments were against them on public safety grounds. But Mangia says people who pose a danger to society shouldn't be eligible for bail anyway.
If you're going to intimidate someone, try to intimidate a witness, tamper with evidence, violate a protective order, you're put in a different category.
Mangia says this bail change is meant for people who don't pose those dangers. His committee could send the proposed rules to the full court for a vote in the coming months. Bail bond agent Courtney Weimer says there are lots of things the courts could do to help people in jail, like letting them retrieve phone numbers for their family members off their cell phones so they can get released more quickly. Meanwhile, public defender Katie Hurley says she'd like to see the courts do more to support defendants who miss court dates because they're homeless or lack transportation. I'm Amy Radel reporting.
For around 15 years, people have slowly dug up mammoth bones near the Tri-Cities. Along the way, people have made a lot of other discoveries. NWPB senior correspondent Courtney Flatt went out to the dig site.
Wind whips through wheat fields in Coyote Canyon on the outskirts of Kennewick. But this spot is home to more than just crops. It's also the site of a glacially paced mammoth dig. Every year, people can tour the site or volunteer to help dig.
Which is way cooler than just seeing a skeleton behind glass at a museum.
That's Neil Mara, a research assistant with the site. Today, a gaggle of third graders from Pioneer Elementary School in Sunnyside tour the site. This is where bones of a Colombian mammoth were found in the late 90s.
Whoa!
That mammoth died 17,500 years ago. It was likely swept here by massive Ice Age floods. Gary Kleinkonnect is the site's education director. He says this mammoth is different from what the kids are probably picturing. Kleinkonnect shows them a painting of a mammoth.
What's missing?
The fur.
The fur, yes, the long hair.
Also, this Colombian mammoth is way bigger than its woolly cousin. A cardboard cutout of its left hind leg is at least 10 feet tall. Just imagine the tusks.
One of those tusks weighed 200 pounds.
200 pounds?
Big tooth.
That impressed 9-year-old Cormac Newhouse.
Mammoths, some of them were bigger than elephants. And like, they're taller than my dad.
When they're not giving tours, volunteers catalog all sorts of tiny things buried around the Coyote Canyon mammoth. Lizards and beetles and rodents. Bax Barton is the site's research director. He says mammoth bones are everywhere. Around 50 have been found in Benton County alone. But this site is helping look at the bigger scientific picture, instead of what often happens to mammoth bones.
Oh, look at the trophy that sits on the mantelpiece or on the professor's office desk and never gets studied. But it's a great paperweight, you know.
He says most scientists don't have the time to look further. At lots of dig sites, landowners want the bones out of the ground as quickly as possible. That way they can keep right on doing whatever it was that led them to discover the mammoth bones. That's not the case here. The landowner has given them all the time they need.
We're beginning to slow down and take a look at the bigger picture for these animals.
Like learning more about the climate and how that changed over time. Other scientists can reach out to study what's been cataloged and preserved. At the dig site, the kids look for tiny bones. But these come from owl pellets, not anything important to the site.
Here we go.
Mara dumps a bucket of dirt onto a super fine mesh screen.
Okay, listen up. We're going to spray water on this dirt and we're going to turn it into mud. And then we're going to reach into the mud with our hands. We're going to stir it all up.
The kids squish the mud through the mesh. What's left are bugs, rocks, and tiny bones.
I found a bone!
That excitement is catching. Mara says every day at the site is an act of discovery.
Boy, doing the digging, it's such a cool thing. It's like opening a Christmas present. You know, you never know what's underneath that next shovel full of dirt.
And there are still a lot more shovels full of dirt to go. Barton says this dig could keep going for another 5 or 10 years. I'm Courtney Flatt in Kennewick.
Wait, there's one. I found a bone. I found a natural bone.
There were few surprises in yesterday's primary election in Idaho. Two-term Governor Brad Little will again be the featured Republican running for the state's top elected office. He defeated 7 opponents. The featured Democrat is attorney Terry Pickens. Pickens defeated 3 others from her party. She says she's ready to take a campaign of affordability to the people.
Number one question is, how are we going to afford to continue to live in this state? One, because our wages have not increased, but our housing costs, the affordability, our gas prices, the groceries, everything has skyrocketed, but Idaho's not kept up in the wage category. So most people are asking, how am I going to even afford to live?
Most of Idaho's statewide candidates, all Republicans, ran unopposed and will now move to face Democrats and third-party candidates in November. About 30% of Idaho voters turned out. Secretary of State Phil McGrane attributes that to the lack of interesting races in most parts of the state. Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Missouri Secretary of State Denny Hoskins told the Associated Press last December he would do everything I can to protect Governor Keough's Missouri First map, unquote. Everything apparently means slow-walking certification of a citizen ballot initiative aimed at overturning the map. The new congressional map splits Kansas City's 5th Congressional District, a seat held by 11-term Democrat Emanuel Cleaver, by diluting black voting power to gain one GOP seat. Pro-voter group People Not Politicians mounted a ballot initiative to repeal the map, but in January, a lawyer for the Secretary of State's office admitted to a judge the state's official description was, quote, likely to create prejudice. Hoskins disqualified 103,000 of the 305,000 signatures submitted last December 9th as having been collected too early. Organizers say they have a minimum of 119% or more from each of Missouri's congressional districts to qualify for the November ballot. State law allows signature verification up to August 4th, 9 months after Hoskins received the petitions. Hoskins said in a press conference he would take all of that time to check signatures. People Not Politicians was back in court May 18th to compel Hoskins to complete the process, saying he was not acting in good faith. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.